the fiddle player that I worked with, he taught me the basics of entertaining people. And he said, first of all, you give the people what they want, you know.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
Hey, how are you? Welcome back. Another episode of Story and Craft. Glad to have you here today. I'm Mark Preston. If this is your first episode, I want to thank you for stopping by. Really cool for you to check out the show. Now, if you've been here before, welcome back. Love the fact you're here. Especially today, a really cool episode. A legend. A guy, you know, to use the phrase, someone who needs no introduction, Tommy Chong is that guy. Everybody knows Tommy Chong. Just in case you're not as familiar with Tommy Chong, he's comedian, a musician, an actor, a writer, a director, an entrepreneur. He's a cannabis advocate. I mean, if you know Tommy, you know he is. You know, Tommy's just a really interesting guy, a lot of fun to talk to, and I'm really jazzed that I get to share this with you. Hey, by the way, don't forget storyandcraftpod.com. Have you been there? Great, thank you. Oh, you haven't? Why not? You got to go by. Check out storyandcraftpod.com. Everything about the show, sign up for the newsletter. Of course, the show's available on your favorite podcast app. Just make sure to subscribe. That way you get notified anytime there's a new episode. Okay? All right. So let's get after it. It is time for a legend. It is Tommy Chong Day right now on Story and Craft.
Thanks so much for taking time out. It means a lot to me. It's such a pleasure to sit down with you and talk to you for a few minutes here. And so many things to cover. I don't even know where to start, really. But first of all, did you have a nice breakfast? Did you get the day started nicely? How's everything going?
You know, my breakfast, the most important meal of my life, of my day. And this morning was no exception. I have a little problem with gout. And whenever I get a little taste of gout, I feel it in my toes. Yeah, I think it's age, you know, and it's excess of protein too. This is what I've been told. And so this morning, I found, I go to Gelson's near my house, and I just started. It's a market where Cheech and I share, because he lives in the Highlands. And they had one of the nicest display of sushi I've ever seen. And I'm trying to stay off of sushi. I think that's why I got gout, because I was such a sushi addict. Anyway, my son's a sushi chef, Paris.
And really?
Yeah.
How did I not know that?
he's not practicing right now. Actually, he learned how to do it because he was working on my brother-in-law's nightclub, and they had a sushi bar there. And my son could have learned how to become a bartender or a sushi chef. And so he picked the sushi chef, which is very smart. And anyway, when he was making sushi in the nightclub catered to a lot of Hell's Angels, the bikers. and my son would make this tuna dish, spicy tuna dish. And these guys, they loved it so much, they couldn't get enough of it. Well, it takes time to do sushi. And if he wasn't working fast enough, the drunk bikers would throw things at him.
Well, how long ago was this? Was this a...
this was years ago. This is when he was like just coming out of school, you know, looking for something to do with his life. But now he still knows how to cook sushi. But the bottom line is that he made this beautiful dish that, like I said, the bikers would riot if he didn't get it to him fast enough. And Gelson's happened to serve it. And I bought some. And that's what I had for breakfast. And so what I'm looking at now is just waiting to see if my toe is going to react. And so far it hasn't.
You know what I also heard, that sometimes, and I don't know, and I'm no doctor, but I heard that if you ever do this, you know, like some people do the intermittent fasting, like if you don't eat like for a day or something, that can kind of trigger it also or something. I don't know.
I believe that. I believe that. Well, you know, what you're doing is your body gets used to certain things, and it gets used to rejecting certain things, especially as you get older, you know.
When I was growing up, you always heard that, like, really wealthy people that eat nothing but steak nonstop, you know, but that's actually like some kind of uric acid or side, I don't even, or some kind of acid.
That's what it is. Uric acid. You nailed it. Yeah. But I was told, in fact, I was in Japan and I was feasting on, in fact, we were staying at a resort and it specialized in seafood, you know, shellfish. And that's when I got probably one of the worst cases of gout in the history of gout. It was so bad, I had to go to the emergency room, and the doctor looked at it, and they just put a needle right into it, directly into it. And I was glad to get that needle because it cured it, it cleaned it up. I don't know what they put in it, but yeah, no, I've been dealing with gout. That was years ago, though. That was back in 07, actually. 07, yeah. You know where I found out I had gout?
Where was that?
In prison.
I
was in prison. I'd been there a couple of days, and I'm walking across the field, and I was limping. I thought I dropped a weight on my foot, you know, weightlifting. And that's what it felt like. But then I thought, I haven't weightlifted or anything, you know. And so on my way to my cell, or my cubicle, we weren't in cells. I had three doctors that were also doing time in jail. And when I was in there, there's about seven doctors, legitimate MDs, you know, doing time for opioid.
Prescribing, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, three of them told me I had gout before I got to my bunk. You got gout.
And I did hear an interview. Now, when you were talking about you being in, which I think is just such a travesty when you think about it, that you weren't, it was for paraphernalia. It wasn't even for any, it was just glass, basically.
No, it was for being Chinese, actually. That's my assessment. No, Bush was looking for an excuse for the, you know, to get the press off his ass during the Iraqi war that he started. Mm-hmm. And so they were going after the hippies like Nixon did back in the Vietnam days. There was nothing going on. And so they came up with this bogus claim that the bomb business was funneling billions of dollars into Al-Qaeda. billions of dollars into Al-Qaeda. And so
when you look at the profit margin on that, it's not, you know, you're going, dude, there's no way.
They went to great lengths. You know what? One of the things they did that was kind of cool, they embedded a financial expert into our company. Because this guy showed up all of a sudden out of nowhere, and he started showing my son, you know, how to run the business more effectively. You know, this guy really knew what he was doing. None of us did. I never knew. My son never knew. You know, there was like, the reason we got in the bong business was that my wife and I were on the road doing comedy, and people would bring up homemade chong bongs and to get them signed. And so my wife says, well, why don't we start manufacturing our own bongs, you know? And so we started the Chong Bong Company. But you know, with that, all the lies going on about making billions of dollars, the government, they embedded a financial expert who actually helped us get out of the red, because we were operating so poorly that the guy couldn't help it.
Wouldn't that be considered entrapment? I mean, basically,
big time. Yeah. Not only that, they filmed everything, and they had to turn it over to us. And so we knew that I was being followed, I was being filmed, I was going to all sorts of head shops, you know, signing my bongs. And what they filmed was me admitting that the bongs weren't really for tobacco use only. That was their big deal. They got me to admit that the bongs were for marijuana.
Now, one of the questions I had for you was, I was thinking that, let's say Up and Smoke, you did that, was it like 78, roughly? I
mean, 78 was the year, yeah.
So would you say in 1978 that if somebody said to you, 44 years later, we would still be dealing with some aspect of a prohibition on cannabis products and all that? I mean, granted, it's, you know, California, Oregon. I mean, there are places it's legal, of course. But would you think by now we would still be dealing with this big question of legalization?
Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20, of course. You know, so at the time, I knew. See, I started bodybuilding when I was quite young. I was 16 years old when I got into bodybuilding. And then I met some serious bodybuilders. And the first thing they did was make me quit smoking and change my diet, you know. But I realized over the years that the only substance that these healthiest people on the planet would do was pot. With marijuana. And they wouldn't let me smoke cigarettes. They wouldn't let me drink alcohol, but they had no problem with me getting high on pot. And so I knew instinctively, or, you know, from that amateur research, that the healthiest people on the planet would smoke pot. So I knew. And so when we did Up and Smoke wasn't supposed to be a stoner movie. Up and Smoke, Lou Adler, our manager, our producer at the time, he was a record producer. He just wanted us to do Cheech and Chong's greatest hits of all the, you know, put all our greatest hits.
Like all your comedy bits, basically.
Yeah, all the comedy bits into a movie. Well, I don't work that way. I we're very improvisational with everything we do, Cheech and I. And so one day I stayed home and I wrote a song called Up and Smoke. And then I sang it for Cheech and Lou the next day. And Cheech says, that's the movie. That's the title of the movie. Well, once it became the title of the movie, then we started writing it with the characters that we put in there. Because Cheech and I together, we did a couple of hundred characters, you know. And so when I wrote Up in Smoke, then Cheech realized that the Chicano character, you know, the lowrider and the hippie, they were the guys. They were what Up in Smoke was all about. And so that's how we went in that direction. But And what I wanted to show in the movie, and I did very well, I did it really well because I wrote the movie. There's a lot of talk that we never had a script.
Yeah. No, you also directed a few of your movies, right?
I directed that one too, but I never got credit for it. See, the way I've always operated is that I've always been in bands, and I've never been the best musician in any band that I ever played in. In fact, I got into music because I had the ability to back up a fiddle player. And I was 8 years old, and he found out I could play a guitar good enough to be able to back him up. And so my whole career has been helping other people in the music industry, you know. So I became known as a good backup guitar player, and so singers would hire me to back them up, and that's how I ended up with a band, and that's how I ended up with a nightclub. But I was more the business guy of all the musicians. I wasn't that good of a musician. I'm a good musician, but I'm not dedicated. You know, I had other interests, and my natural instinct was giving the people what they want. I could sense what the audience was looking for. And that came from when I was 8, 9 years old. The fiddle player that I worked with, he taught me the basics of entertaining people. And he had said, first of all, you give the people what they want. You know, don't switch and bait and switch, you know.
Being a showman is its own its own craft, you know.
Yeah. And he taught me, and he says, give the people what they want. And if they want the same tune over and over again, give it to them, you know, and be glad to do it. And so he taught me that lesson. And so then at an early age of my life, I learned how to make people happy, you know. It wasn't my plan, but it was my ability to be a solid backup guitar player for these guys. And that's what they needed. And that's been my whole career. And so when I got into like comedy, for instance, you know, I was in the comedy before Cheech. Cheech came later. I had been doing the comedy routine for about maybe 6 months. And then Cheech joined. And then we were together again for another maybe 3 months. And then Cheech and I, then we got fired from my own club.
Well, that's how you know you're really in the business. You got to get fired that first time, you know?
Yeah.
Now, well, how did you? I know you've probably told the story a million times. I've just never heard it. But how did you meet? How did y'all two connect initially?
Well, we had a after hours club, which was given to me, basically. I was the one that was interested in it. You know, the band, we had a singer that was very flamboyant and not that good of a singer, but he entertained. And then we had other musicians that were just more or less into the music part. I was more into the business part of it, you know. So when we got offered a nightclub, I jumped on all over, you know. Yeah.
Is this in Los Angeles or?
No, this is in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, that's right. Because aren't you from Edmonton originally?
I was born in Edmonton and raised in Calgary.
And I gotcha.
And then I got deported to Vancouver. So we're in Vancouver. The club was so successful, it became so successful that another club was given to us by another Chinese friend of mine whose club wasn't doing very well. So I turned that club, the one that was given to us, into a titty bar. And so the bikers, you know, a lot of bikers in Vancouver. So we had a very rough crowd there. So when I got fired from Motown, which is another story, I went back to the clubs and I started working the lights at the titty bar. You know, the other after hours club was doing fine, but the titty bar was more fun to be in. And then I realized that I could turn this club into an improvisational comedy club, which I did, using the girls who are beautiful and very funny as comedians. But I needed another partner. So I talked to doorman, his name was Dave, I wanted him to be the MC. I was just going to work the lights. And then Dave said, well, I'll do it if you do it. And so he called my bluff and I said, okay. So next thing you know, I'm on stage with Dave. And then we needed a straight man because Dave and I both had real long hair. And back then it was, you know, long hairs were like, you know, the dirty hippies. And you always had a straight guy with the straight haircut. So we had a straight man named Rick Lenz, a real actor. Because once I started the improv club, it attracted actors. And so I got all the acting community in Vancouver all excited about this club that I had. And then so I started having actors hang out. But the straight guy, Rick, we were so popular that we got a front page picture of Rick with the strippers on either side of him with their, with their titties in the Rick's ear. And so Rick's wife, and Rick, we never saw Rick after that picture. Rick disappeared, his wife.
Because his wife's like, that's what you're up to.
He told his wife that he was doing comedy theater, like, what do you call it? Community theater. And so I needed a straight guy. And so this one customer, a Russian kid, that he said, I know the perfect guy for your act. And I says, he says, come on out and meet him. And so I went out and I met Cheech. He was Richard Marin, by the
way. Right, right.
And Richard was up in Vancouver, Canada, dodging the draft. He was trying not to go to get killed in Vietnam. And so none of us knew, the strippers or any of the people in the club knew, that Cheech really was Mexican, because he had been such a good actor. You know, we thought, we didn't know what he was. He was brown something. and so we didn't know. I didn't really know he was Mexican until we came down to L.A. And that's when I found out, when we, the first time we found out that we were funny together, we had a band. We were going to play music, and Cheech is a singer. But we never got around to playing one note, because Cheech and I did 45 minutes of comedy and found out that that was it. We were a comedy team. And so that's when I found out his nickname was Cheech, because we were trying to find a name for our group, and Cheech and Chong turned out to be the winner. And then we snuck back into LA, and the rest is history.
Now, is that where he's from originally? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, he was from LA. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the things I loved about your movies when I was probably too young to be watching them way back when, was, my view of LA was always the glitz, the glam, you know, the watching Emergency, or Chips, you know. To me, that was LA. It's like, but there was this whole Chicano side. There was this whole other, like, I was like, and so I was equally enamored with, oh, there's this whole, like, you know, other side as a little kid, like with this whole LA thing. I started becoming enamored, like, but no, what you were saying before about how you supported somebody, how you like, kind of like to back him up. I mean, that's, there were scenes in your movies I can think of that Cheech is, you know, he's got the lines and it's kind of focused on him. Like, for instance, him getting pulled over. There's this scene, and I don't know what movie it's from. The policeman's like, I see your license. And he's like, isn't it on the back of the car? You know?
Yeah. Isn't it on the bumper?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're there. It's like, visually you're doing something. I think you're always kind of in the background.
Yeah.
Doing something, you know, you're supporting him. So it's not like you're just sitting there letting him, you know.
No.
There's so much visual comedy that that I think was just, you know, he was the boisterous one, but but he had a lot of visual, like, you know, this one scene sticks out of my mind. I don't know what movie it is. You're playing guitar in the house and he's trying to get into the door. Apparently you got so many monitors going, he can't get the door open, you know, and he's like, but I think grossly underappreciated physical comedians, I will say. You know, you grew up in Canada. Now, did your folks, when they saw the kind of mischief you're up to, did they understand it? Did they, like, did they think it was cool? Did they think it was just ridiculous? What was your family thinking about your endeavor?
Well, you know, it was my dad, really, that encouraged me, because, you know, the party, to play guitar. My dad really, you know, he is very traditional Chinese, but he never spoke Chinese around the house. He never taught us anything. We were like his Caucasian family, you know, because my mother was a very beautiful, I found out later, was 25% Native, but we always thought she was Scotch-Irish. And my dad was Chinese, of course. And so my dad, he treated us and mom and the family more like his white family, you know. And he was, so when I started, when we did the nightclubs, you know, my dad and mom, everybody came. My brother actually managed all the clubs, leaving me to go on the road, you know, with the bands and everything else. So my parents, my dad, he was very traditional. He was in the Second World War. He didn't have to go. He was in Canada, and they didn't want Chinese in the war. But in the Army, but he enlisted with his friends, and he was born and raised in Vancouver and Edmonton too, where he met my mother. But my parents were sort of, you know, tradition, but they went along with me because, you know, when one of the kids is an entertainer, you know, the whole world revolves around it. I remember my sister, she was a tap dancer, and she went on the road with the tap dancing crew one time, and we followed her. We drove her, and that's when I got a taste of the entertainment world, you know. And so being an entertainer, I was, you know, I was lofted to a, let me tell you a story about my uncle. My dad had a brother who I was named after, Tommy. My dad and my brother were opposites. My dad was, rough and ready to go to war. And he was a pool hustler one time, you know. He wasn't tall. He was 5'3", but he ended up being a big, distant truck driver, you know. So he was a macho kind of guy, very macho, very tough too. But my uncle, Tommy, was an academic. He never got out of school. He stayed in the University of Alberta until he died at the age of 80 something. He was a diving coach, even though he couldn't swim, but he was a gymnast. And he was also an intellect, you know. He was, and he wasn't really thrilled with my dad or his family until I started getting written up in the movie section. And because I carry his name, all of a sudden I became his favorite nephew, you know.
Well, so, how many kids were in your family? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had a brother and a sister, and my sister's still with us. My brother passed a couple of years ago, and we were named after him. My mother was very, she went the Chinese route when she met my dad, and she adopted everything Chinese, and she had three kids, like my dad's family. There was my dad, Stan, and my uncle Tommy, and my aunt Nellie, who I never met. She died before I met. But, and my mother had three kids too, and she named them Stan, Tommy, and Nellie. yeah.
So about what year, was it 1969, 1970-ish roughly? Is that when you came to L.A.?
We came to L.A., yeah, it was actually 1969 in Vancouver and 1970-71 in L.A. And 71 was when we put out our first album, our first record. Age not,
yeah, I think
here.
That's one of the things I love that you share in your time here, because I mean, I think there's a generation, my kids' generation, hasn't really been exposed to the things that you did, or the era of comedy albums, you know.
No.
and back how big of a deal they were back. I was just watching the George Carlin documentary that Jim Apatow did, and I was remembering, it's like, man, I remember sitting down. Well, I mean, we're saying it now. It's, of course, Bill Cosby. But you know, sitting down listening to these albums that my father had, this big old collection, and I would I wouldn't understand half of what was going on. But that was a big thing. And then to transition from doing the comedy albums to getting on camera and bringing these characters to film, how did that come to be? How did y'all decide, okay, we're going to start acting on camera now?
That was me. I got really tired of going to Australia every year to work, because every time we'd go out of the country, you know, to a new country, I would have to write a new show. And writing a show, doing an album is one thing, you know, that takes a lot of work and time and everything else, but it's fun too. Live shows, they're tough, because you have to repeat it every time. You do a comedy album, it's done. You know, you can repeat it maybe in a show, but for the most time, it's done. When you do live shows, you got to do a live show every night. And so we had been to Australia a couple of times, and it was work. Yeah, but we had, we never had Mexicans there. See, when Cheech and Chong go on the road, unless we're going to like a Spanish friendly country, we're not accepted the way we are, say, in L.A. You know, like, in fact, we were killing them in L.A. We had lineups around the block, celebrities, everybody wanted to see us in L.A. We went to New York, and we were teaching. I were very excited, you know, because we have, you know, we're by, you know, we're all over the place. New York, L.A., doesn't matter. But the audience, if you don't have a Chicano audience with Cheech and Chong, you're going to get a whole different show. And that's what with Australia. And so New York was such a wake up, because Cheech and I were basking in the glory of all the Chicanos, you know. And then you get to New York, and New York is deadly. If you're not funny, if you just show the slightest bit of hesitation in New York, you're dead. You know, people will kill you there. In fact, when Cheech and I broke up, my wife and I were doing comedy, and she was like starting out on her own doing stand up, Shelby, and we were in Andrew Dice Clay's territory in New Jersey. Deadly. Shelby went out, and there wasn't one laugh. It was horrible. But that showed you how tough the my lady is, because after I said, you know, it was not one laugh, nothing. You know, usually they're polite enough to give you an applause or something, but it was, they just, you know, that's the way Andrew Dice Clay's crowd were, you know, just like, you know, they're horrible. They're like Trumpies, you know. And so we ended up, so she never got one laugh, and she's walking up. And in my mind, I said, well, this will either make her or break her, you know. And so I said to her, as I went on stage, I said, pretty tough, huh? And she said, F them.
She well, said, you know, F them. She she's kind of built up that callus to be able to handle those folks now, you know. Yeah. But like, you know, that's one of the questions you mentioned, Andrew Dice Clay, and you know, you go back to Sam Kinison, you go back, as I was coming up in the 80s watching comedy, you had Eddie Murphy doing these big, almost like, you know, these big arena shows. Yeah,
yeah.
You had,
yeah,
a lot of folks doing that. You don't hear about that nearly as much. I mean, no. It seems like the 80s, was that a real heyday for comics to put on just killer big shows? And what's the difference between then and now in your mind?
Well, now it's more sophisticated, and it's more segregated. You know, like at one time, Bill Cosby was the opposite of Eddie Murphy, but they were both black. You know, but Cosby was appealed to the whiter blacks, and Eddie Murphy appealed to all blacks. You know, it was almost like the ones that are in prison, the ones that are out of prison, almost. It's almost that ghetto or upper class, you know. But now there's so that what's that culture? I can never remember the phrase. I had to change my act. Listen, you know, I never considered, you know, I mean, I was married. My first wife is black. I got two black kids, you know, daughters. I never, ever considered myself anything less than, you know, a brother. You know, I was there. We did a bit called Blind Melon Chitlin. And it was a takeoff on a blind blues singer. And no, I got the premise or the idea from the committee. It was an acting group out of San Francisco. They did a bit similar, but then I saw T-Bone Walker. Now, I am a guitar player, and I saw T-Bone at his height, and then I saw him at his lowest part. And it was the lowest part that inspired us to do Blind Melon Chimney. Well, I'm getting, you know, to me, it was like, it wasn't insulting or any of that stuff. But I was ready to do a show in Reno, Cheech and I and Shelby, and Herbie Hancock, the great Herbie Hancock, the jazz guy, he was a big fan. And I knew that because one time he had us appear on his in Switzerland at the jazz concert. They had a jazz show there in Switzerland. And Cheech and I were invited. We came and worked a little bit, you know, emceed a little bit. Herbie's a big fan. So Herbie, we're talking because he's going to appear in Reno after Cheech and I, Chong Lee. And then Herbie, he said, you know, it was a serious discussion. He was trying to get to me about my Blind Melon Chimney bit. And the way he said it was, hey, man, you know, when you do the Blind Melon thing, he says, you start off playing, you know, you got that playing really good jazz, you know, like good music, you know, and then you get into that other shit.
He's like, well, you mean the thing I do for a living? Yeah.
Yeah. But when he said that, I looked at him. No, I respect jazz guys more than, you know, to me, they're the real spiritual leaders of the country.
Yeah, indeed.
Know? And so it really struck home. And even though I did Blind Melon Chimney after that, I changed the act. See, when Cheech and I did it, it was all visual. He was too drunk to really play. And so he just did all these visual funny things that were very funny and would get the crowd on the floor laughing. And then when Cheech and I broke up, I started doing the Blind Melon Chimney voice and doing jokes, bits, you know, different black bits, you know. In fact, I did appear in blackface on Still Smoking in the movie, because I always felt that blind, you know, had the soul of a black man, and but obviously not, because Herbie Hancock saw it. He saw through it. And so,
well, this is kind of like Mel Brooks, you know. A lot of his comedy, it was never making fun of. It was trying to embrace the. It was parody. Yeah, it was trying to kind of celebrate the culture in a way where people are like, okay, I get it. He's not making fun of us, you know. But it's a fine line. But I just don't think that could happen today. You know, I think that people are too quick on the trigger to not political correctness. I don't know.
Was it culture stealing the culture or something? Culture.
Appropriation, I think. Yeah,
culture appropriation. Yeah. All that weird talk, you know. But then, if you look at, like, I watched All in the Family, and All in the Family just showed Archie Bunker. They're another, you know, Trumpy, right off the bat. You know, I mean, this guy was really sick in his head for what he believed.
But it was parodying that guy. But you're also empathetic, and I think that's great acting and great, you know, great comedy. Is you can be empathetic to the ridiculous one. You know, you can kind of, he's like, all right. But when you had the offshoot, which is the Jeffersons, the interaction he had with his name escapes
George.
Me. Yeah,
George.
Yeah, the interaction that they had was just like they're going at each other, which is in its own way kind of funny because they're both being real from their own perspective, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that the comedy is just very, it was nuanced, you know, I guess you could say. But like you listen, it was you talked about Bill Cosby before and who he was appealing to. And I remember one of the bits that Eddie Murphy did. He was talking about how he got a call from Bill, you know, Bill Cosby saying, hey, you know, you need to dial back on that, you know, four letter words and all that. And he calls up Richard Pryor. He's like, Richard, what do you think? You know, of course, Richard Pryor's like, you know, hell with him, man. You know, I'm sure more colorful language, like, do your thing. You know, it's like, because Richard Pryor was, I think that there's so many comedians now that you can trace back the DNA to, you know, that Eddie Murphy. Well, Eddie Murphy traces his DNA back to, you know, Richard Pryor. So I don't know. I love comedy. I think I grew up in a really wonderful time. And I think in the 80s, it was all happening. You had Sam Kinison, which is just, you know.
Totally off the wall.
Yeah.
Totally.
You know, and watch. Have you seen that documentary that Judd Apatow did on George Carlin? Have you seen
it? I did.
And I never knew this. George Carlin had seen Sam Kinison and recognized, wait a minute, I need to make some adjustments because I don't want to be kind of an afterthought.
Left behind.
Yeah.
Left behind.
Yeah, and the weren't you on his show once? Back at the George Carlin show.
I sure was. And I got to know George. One thing about George that nobody really talked about, even in the documentary, I was shocked that he's a piano player.
Really? I didn't know that.
He had a group one time. He played in a group. He can play piano. That's where he got all the word stuff from. You know, he was very musical.
Yeah, I always thought I came up in Dallas radio, and I always thought it was kind of cool because, like, you know, George Carlin worked in Fort Worth radio, you know, Dallas.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's like, that's kind of cool. And this is where the seven words came. The FCC got their seven words from is this guy, you know, George Carlin to me. You know, one of the funny things, I was wondering if you could kind of clarify, that I saw was they actually referred to Cheech in this. And they said that there was some time in the 80s where they said
Cheech said he was
get kind of passe. It's like, okay, you know, George Carlin's the 1970s.
He's obsolete. He said he was obsolete. George Carlin was obsolete. And Cheech denies saying that. I asked Cheech about it, you know, and he denied saying it. He could very well have said it one time. But Cheech used to do one of George bits.
Really?
Just pull the twine, something, you know, cowboy, you're doing a takeoff on a cowboy scene. I knew George. I was on his show. I never got tight with him, you know. And by the way, I saw the last show George did. There was a whole slew of comedians at the Wadsworth Theater in Westwood, and it was George's last performance.
Really? And you saw that?
Yeah, I saw that. Norm Cosby was there. What was it? Remember the guy that used to have the newspaper under his arm? The very first, what was his name? He did commentary on I can't think of his name right now.
But I think I know what you're talking about. I'm brain farting on it.
It was his last show. In fact, it was because of that. It was going to be his last show, period. And he died shortly after that. But I saw all those last shows. And it was quite a thrill for me because, we grew up with all those guys.
Well, yeah, but you also know how much goes into building an act and and just working it out over and over. And just till you get your show set, your HBO show set, you know, they don't see all the time you're in these dark clubs working it out. But, you know, George Carlin, I think, starting in about 2016, I wish it was like, God, this is the time he was meant to be here. You know, 2016 forward when politically and everything going on in our world. I mean, this is the stuff he was commenting on. And people thought he was extremely cynical or whatever. I was like, no, he's got some perspective that maybe he was a little bit of a forecaster, you know.
Oh, he was. And well, the truth is, I think you got to be very careful when you're a comedian. I had the honored me at the Skirball in Los Angeles. Do you know where the Skirball is?
I've never heard that about that before.
Oh, Skirball is a Jewish center, a community center kind of thing.
Oh, okay. And I got you. It's like off Fairfax or something? Or
yeah. No, it's up on 405 near the Getty Museum, near the museum up there.
Okay.
As you go up there, and it's Skirball, it's called. And it's a Skirball Center. And so they're going to honor me. And anytime anybody honors anybody, it's just a scam, really, to get them to do an act for nothing. You know, you get a plaque. You get a plaque or you get a meal. But and usually they have a lot of other comedians on. And they're doing their act and everything else. Well, they wanted to honor me. Well, I'm kind of in, I only went into comedy after when we broke up. I was always a part of a comedy team and I was very comfortable with that. When Cheech and I broke up, I saw Dennis Miller. Remember Dennis Miller?
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw Dennis Miller in Vancouver, and he was in this little comedy club. I knew the owner of the comedy club, and he said, Dennis Miller's playing. Oh, so I went down, and I met Dennis. And Dennis is all nervous before the show, and neat little guy, you know. And he said to me, he says, do you still get nervous before you go on? And I hadn't been on stage for years by that time and
yeah.
Doing movies and that. And he just caught me. He just caught me in a net. And then I watched his show and I sat there thinking, I got to do this. I got to do this. This is what I got to do. And so right after Dennis Miller, that was Christmas of 93, I believe. Because as soon as I got back to L.A., I went on. I found out, you know, the freebies, the comedy club where you can go work, and there was one in this. It's kind of poetic justice in it. Cheech and I did a song one time. You know that Eric My Eye. You know I'm so bloody rich. I own apartment buildings and shopping centers. Well, the comedy club that I was going to work in was the shopping center that we were part owners of.
You call it the irony tour, yeah.
And so I'm getting ready to go on stage on stage for the first time by myself. I got myself a nice sports jacket, you know. I was going to be like a stand-up comedian, you know, and like Dennis Miller kind of. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, the night before, Rodney King got whacked.
Oh, that's right. It was a 92?
93.
Oh, 93. Okay.
93. And that happened the night before. So I saw it. And then, so I wrote down a few bits about it. And when I went on stage, that was the first thing I did was talk about the Rodney King beating. And I said, it's funny how mothers, it doesn't matter why you're on TV, mothers will get excited just seeing their son on TV. And I say, I could just visualize the cop's mother, you know, saying, oh, that's my boy. See the one that was beating? That's my boy. Look at him. Oh, you laugh.
Yeah.
And I got a few chuckles. But the first thing a guy said after I did that bit, hey, where's Cheech?
Well, what is that like, though, being so, you know, independently, y'all have done, you know, y'all definitely stand on your own two feet, had great projects and endeavors and entrepreneurial things that you've done. But what's it like to kind of spend a career that you've got a career brother, as it were? You know, you're kind of hard to talk about one of y'all without thinking about the other. What is that like? Is it ever impeded you anything you've done in a way? Like, it's like, oh man, I'm trying to kind of break out of this. You know, like right there on stage, somebody's like, where's Cheech? You know, is that something that bothers
you? I think, No, not at all. Not at all. No, I'm like I said, I grew up backing up people.
Yeah.
So I totally understand, you know, and me talking, you know, when people found out I was a comedian, they didn't believe it. They thought it was somebody else because I've gone, you know, I've known people all my life where I never talked. I knew, you know, I was a backup guitar player. You know, I have nothing to say except and whisper, what chord are we in? Yeah, whisper.
He wanted to do more acting stuff. You know, he was, you know, that was, he was on a board, like, I want to say straight as opposed to, you know.
No, you're
but
right.
He's one of, you know, non-comedic necessary, you know, maybe he was playing the kind of funny guy in it. But after that happened, what was kind of your what were your endeavors? What were you up to at that point in time whenever he was doing his thing?
I was really on a roll because I had directed, I wrote and directed. What happened when we got screwed out of the Up and Smoke money, which was a good thing, because had we cashed in, we probably would not have done what we did, you know. Mm-hmm. And so
it kind of made you hungry, I guess, right?
Yeah. So it kept us in the game. The thing that really bothered me was when, Cheech got all the, you know, all the lines, you know, he was the lead guy, you know, like the lead singer. You know, I was a backup guy. But when he had a chance, see, and I wrote most of the bits, but when he had a chance to write something just on for Cheech, that's all he did. He just wrote it for Cheech. He never included Chong. And I'm talking about Born in East L.A.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
see,
yeah.
Born in East L.A. was a takeoff of Bruce Springsteen's song, Born in the USA.
Yeah.
While Cheech turned it to Born in East L.A., which is fine. It was great. Except when it came to put my part in, he never had a part for me. And then he says, oh, no, I called him out on it, you know, because he was telling me, you know, he wrote the song Born in East L.A. I said, oh, great, you know. No, that's for him. But then he it was Cheech and Chong at the time. So he put it down. It was written by Cheech and Chong. And it was, everything is Cheech and Chong, except the performance. And so I said to him, where's my part? You know, he said, oh, you play a cop. Well, to me, you know, that's one of the biggest insults you could do. Unless you add the comedy part. Okay, you're a cop, but here's your comedic role.
Yeah, where his focus is very narrow about how he's going to become, you know, you're thinking globally. You know, you're thinking about the whole project.
That's the way I thought about everything, the movies, everything. You know, I never think. And it wasn't until, you know, lately that I realized that he did his best he could do. You know, that was the best he could do, and that was the best he could come up with. And so as a result, we just quit communicating. I'm going to show him.
Did he come?
Yeah, he came. He's going to talk to you.
And he looked at both of them?
Yeah, he's going to talk to you.
Okay.
Thanks. Was that Shelby?
My darling wife just walked in.
I love hearing y'all with when y'all were doing the podcast. By the way, I want you to do a podcast of Paris again. I used to love when Shelby would show up. That was fun.
Well, you go way back with us.
No. I loved, you know, listening to the two of y'all. It's like, man, this is some non-traditional but awesome father-son time. I love this, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, he's Paris. All my kids. That was the other thing, too, you know, with Cheech, you know. Cheech, well, you know, he was raised by policemen.
Really?
You know? His dad's was an LAPD. And in fact, his dad rose up quite high in the LAPD, became a teacher. He was very well respected. And so Cheech all his life was had to deal with his dad being a cop. That's why the lowrider was a big stretch for him. Cheech did not want to go down that route. And we never knew he was Mexican until he came to, till we came to LA. And then one time we were working a club and we weren't going over because we were doing all our Canadian humor. And I said to Cheech, I said, you're from here, man. Come on, there must be a character, you know, that you can. And he said, yeah, there is one, but I'm not too. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, you know, it's a little detrimental. And he denied saying this conversation, by the way. And he says, it's a little detrimental, but, and the Chicano, the top Chicanos had a meeting, the guy that, Luis Valdez, you know, the director, anyway, the intellectual Chicano community did not like the character Cheech was portraying, you know, which is why we never had low riders up until Cheech. And we haven't really had a low rider since, you know, because they.
I know y'all have done some things over the last few years. Are y'all kind of contemplating ever doing a project together? Anything else anytime soon?
There's a movie out. There's a movie getting prepped now that they want us in there. And Cheech will probably go for it. It's an older version of us. You know, it's now at our age now, you know. We'll have to see how it looks in that. We've got a documentary that's coming out that's going to it's a Cheech and Chong documentary. The backstory or the behind the scenes story is pretty funny because you know me, I'm sort of spur of the moment kind of guy, you know. And so it's my daughter, Robbie, and her guy, Dave. Now, Dave is a very talented movie maker. Worked with Jim Carrey and Sling Blade. He did Sling Blade, and he's definitely a movie maker. And they were doing a documentary on Cheech and Chong, and it seemed like it was never going to get finished. And so one day I was driving home with a friend of mine. We did a golf tournament and I came up, I got high on one of my products and I come up with a great idea for the ending of a documentary. Because that's the way I kind of work, you know, if we got stuff to do. I'm an artist in a sense that if there's an empty canvas and people can't think of what to put on it, I will eventually come up with an idea, you know, and
a destination. And then you kind of plot out the journey to get there.
Yeah. Well, I came up with a real good ending for the documentary and to the point where I told my daughter, I said, listen, forget all this other stuff. I got an ending, blah, blah, blah.
The director comes back. Yeah.
Oh my God. That caused such a riot because I am the guy. They're doing a thing. I do have the power if I wanted to. And they freaked. They actually drove all the way to San Francisco to talk to Cheech to make sure that Cheech would not go along with me. Because if Cheech went along with me, that would be the end of the day. Anyway, Cheech would definitely not go along with me. Cheech and I really haven't seen eye to eye on anything. I mean, we've been on going, you know, we've been doing our live act with Shelby and that, you know, ever since the 08, actually, as soon as I got out of jail. We were supposed to do a movie before I went to jail, but then I went to jail and that kind of screwed everything up. It wouldn't have happened anyway. You know, I didn't. Well, they've had people write movies for us. And I look at the first couple of pages and know that, you know, you can't write for Cheech and Chong. You know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably, it would come off as a parody almost. You know, I think people kind of see it as, which what y'all did was, like I said, the physical comedy, it gave you a chance. I mean, like you sitting next to him in a car, just slowly eating everything that you had. I mean, what was that movie? God, you were eating everything so that the cop wouldn't see. It's just, I couldn't take my eyes off you. It's like, wait a minute, he has no lines, but it's hilarious, you know? And in other words, y'all, do you think it's that, it's not friction, but do you think it's that contrast that kind of gave y'all the fuel to kind of create what y'all have, you know, not necessarily seeing eye to eye on stuff?
Two things. First of all, we're exploring new territory. You know, see, we're not rehashing anything. See, a lot of movies are rehash, remake, redo, redo, da-da, da-da, you know, because then you know who the guys are and what the end result's going to be.
And it's a safe choice for a lot of people, especially, I mean, just look at all the remakes they're making movies these days. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. They understand, they know all the moves, the dance, and everything else. Cheech and I invented a new style of comedy that only Cheech and I can perform. You know, I can't do it with anybody else. That's the special thing about Cheech and Chong. That's why Martin and Lewis had the same thing.
It was
a very spontaneous. In fact, Jerry Lewis gave me one of the best compliments ever. He said, when they said, you know, they don't have comedy teams like you and Dino. And Jerry said, oh, yeah, they do. He said, Cheech and Chong.
Yeah, and the thing is, Jerry Lewis, even though he played the kind of the goofy guy, he was the one really meticulously crafting those acts, and really Martin was the one to show up and be Dean Martin, you know?
That's right. And do his lines and do his things and be the handsome guy. No, I really respected Jerry's filmmaking. In fact, I used his technique. You know, he was the first to use video.
Yeah, he was the first one to kind of do that, to kind of video monitor idea. So he could actually do it. Yeah. Isn't that crazy to think Jerry Lewis did that? I mean, it's like the most common thing now, but Jerry Lewis, before him, nobody did that. Yeah.
I was the second. The second to do it, yeah. Because when we did the next movie, I hired a video guy. And the DP, King Baggett, was pissed off. He did not. He didn't want me. The cameramen, you know, they're like dogs. They don't want any other dog on the set.
In the scene, you've got to see playback to see if it worked. Yeah.
But guess what? King Baggett ended up almost marrying Eric Wooster, my video guy. I would go to see the scene, and King Baggett would be in there first. King was in there late bunching, because King is not worried about the performance. He's worried about the lighting.
Yeah,
the
book, lighting, composition, and all that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, King loved it after that. And now, in fact, you don't even use a film camera anymore. You just use video. You know, it's all video now. No, Jerry was an innovator in that sense. And the thing is about, Jerry knew too. See what happened with Jerry and Dean. Jerry kind of took over. And that's what happened with Cheech and I too. Because once you become a film director, that's like being anointed God. everything depends on what the director says.
Yeah, and everything's sitting on your shoulders as well, because if something fails, it's all on you. Yeah.
I got so hooked on that Cheech and I just when we start having separate dressing rooms, you know, because up until then we always shared a dressing room, you know. And because when we're in the dressing room, we could talk, we could write, and I could tell Cheech, you know, give Cheech, direction, because with Cheech, all you have to do is just, he's like an encyclopedia, because he can memorize so many things, and so I just show Cheech a direction, and Cheech gets it right away, boom, I know what you mean, and so when we weren't, see what happened with Lou Adler, after Up in Smoke, we got, you know, I directed and wrote right up to the end. And then Lou Adler says, you know, because he's a director, and I found out now that he wanted to take all the money too. So he, at the end of Up in Smoke, he kind of barred me from the set, you know. And I said, are you ready? And they said, oh, no, we've already shot that. And I said, oh, because usually they call me in, you know, to make sure everything was right. You know, Bob was really the director. Then Lou took over to the point where Lou says, okay, I got a good idea. Yeah, working on the ending. You know, we got enough. Like Lou is the kind of producer that we run out of money, stop everything, and we're finished. You know, just really? You know,
that's one. You know. Instead, it's like it's kind of like money's done. Okay, cut. It's wrap.
We're done. So what happened? I backed down, and they edited the movie. They being Lou and Lou Lombardo, the editor, and that, and then they showed us the rough cut, or the first assembled part, and they showed Paramount too at the same time. It was the worst fucking ending of any movie I'd ever seen. It was so bad. Everything that we had done might as well be, you know, forgot about it.
Really?
Because the ending was what he did. I'll tell you, no one will ever see it. But what the ending was that Lou came up with was that it was all a dream. And that when we were at the when we were stopped on the PCH, and that's where everything after the PCH was a dream, and we were sort of somehow, and Stacy shows up as a uniform.
Stacy Keach.
Yeah. I mean, it was like. It was, you couldn't get, I haven't really been able to have a conversation with Lou since, period, about anything, you know, other than, hi, how's everything? Yeah, nice. How's the kids? How's that? You know, before that, he was always interested in, you know, what do you want to shoot now? Or what should we do now?
And now, Up in Smoke was the one where y'all had that little van that had the marijuana sprayed on the side of it. And the exhaust pipe was too hot and started igniting and everything. Okay. Because I forgot if that was Up in Smoke or the next movie.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to be, I mean, his idea to save money was it was all a dream. And it was the biggest fucking insult ever. And so then I said, that was the end. And so I told everybody, we got to reshoot the ending. I'm directing. And that was it. And
well, how much of the final print, how much of that did you end up directing?
The ending. The ending. I wrote and basically showed him what to do, you know. I mean, you know, I actually directed the whole movie when it came right down to it, you know. The only thing I'll give Lou and everybody credit for is that Stacy wrote his own lines. I give him an idea of what we wanted to do. Strother Martin, you know, you get a job by sundown. That was all Strother Martin ad lib. He wrote every bit of that monologue. That was Strother Martin. And he never got credit for it. The Ajax lady snorting, that was all her stuff, you know. And so what I would do, I would gather this stuff and teach a story, teach Peanut in the Hamper, teach
I love the keeping stuff. The beers in the fish tank. That just made sense to me, you know. It's like
that was me.
I was like, that makes for a good cooler, you know.
And washing. No, that was next movie, but that was yeah. So next movie really was me. Me and Cheech.
It's the best title for a sequel ever, because it is the Cheech and Chong's next movie. It's easy to remember, you know.
Yeah.
This trip down memory lane is so much fun. And I really think that, have you noticed, like Gen Z millennials, have they rediscovered your movies? Have you had any feedback from people that have kind of started finding your stuff going, oh yeah, I know, it's like Tommy Chong is he's the weed guy, but it's like, no, there's this whole thing. Yeah.
They know me from that 70s show.
Oh yeah.
They know me because that's an extension of that character. That's what I was trying to get through to Cheech, you know, which I never did, was the fact that those iconic characters can live forever. Will live forever. You can't kill them, and you can only you can only live off them. And I did that with that with my character. See, there was more to making the movies. I wanted to put a message out to the world. Number one, if you can smoke dope and still be healthy and still work out.
Oh, you have always been in really great shape. I mean, working out and lifting has always been a big thing with you.
That's it. I mean, and to this day now, I'm selling CBD that it's good for you. See, I don't want to do anything or even lead the people down the wrong path with a character even. I refuse because I know the effect that I have on people. They listen to me, you know, and they not only listen to me, but they will repeat what I say, you know, like with the CBD that I'm selling now, you know, that's going crazy as far as people liking it. And it's good for you. And that's the thing about weed. That's why I'd never promote any kind of smoking cigarettes, you know, tobacco or alcohol. I had a chance to, you know, to do a beer, and I went to even right to the brewery because I wanted to check it all out, you know. And then I had a flash of a car wreck with Chong beer scattered around, you know. and I said, no, I don't want that tag. You can be the nicest guy all your life, but you mess up one time, man, you're done. You know,
it's funny because I was talking with my kids. My daughter is at college right now. She's going to be a sophomore. My son's going to the same school next year as a freshman. And I was telling them, I was trying to find a way to put it. There's so much mischief going on, people spiking drinks and all that. I was like, you know, if you were in a room and you and your girlfriends show up and there's some guys there, you know, have a little get together and they're all just blackout drunk. They're just drinking. I said, in a way, I would rather them be in a room with some guys that have been smoking. And that's it. That's the only thing. Because yeah. I think it's ultimately, I feel like it's safer for them to be in that scenario than with guys that have been, you know, college and just drinking and all that. I mean, you know, you're a parent, you know, it's your job to worry about your kids all the time, no matter how old they are. And, but it's like, I'm not advocating it necessarily, but I'm saying, listen, the reality is the people that are going to sit back and smoke, they got a different mentality and people just pounding beers and, you know, alcohol.
Yeah.
And that's poison. I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, it's, you know, it takes a toll on you after a while.
Well, the best way is by example, you know. And that's what I've done all my life. It's just by example. Now, you know what I found out is that they will. If you're doing something right, they people will pick up on it, and they will copy you. And I've had that happen. You know, I've had people, you know, copy exactly what I do, and to me, it's a beautiful thing. Like if someone does Cheech and Chong bits, I don't. You get offended. I take that. I'm very proud of that. I love the
fact they're keeping it alive. And I think
that's right. They're paying homage to me.
I certainly appreciate it. I just want to wrap up real quick. I got a quick 7 questions for you. These are just my fun questions. These are just, okay. I always wrap up every interview with it. First one is, what is your favorite comfort food, that thing that's like you love snacking on it, or you just kind of go to it? It's just, you know, you always have to have it around the house.
Well, I guess croissants.
Croissants? Well, that's
toasted croissant is my favorite.
Yeah, my oldest daughter loves those. Yeah, those are tasty. A little butter, a little few calories in there.
Oh, toasted. Oh, I love it.
Now, if you're going to sit down, next question, 3 people, you're going to have a cup of coffee. You're going to be talking story for a while. Who would those 3 people be, living or not? You know, if you could sit down and have spent a few hours just talking about life with 3 people, who would it be?
What's his name that was messed up? The in the wheelchair, could hardly talk.
The doctor from England, the astrophysicist, was he an astrophysicist? Him? Or
That's him.
Oh, not see his thing. When I try to remember somebody's name, that's my brain goes, nope, not going to do it. Hawking, Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking. Moses. I really identify with Moses. And because he was so influential, still influential in my life, is Jesus.
Uh-huh. Very good. Yeah. Very good. So next question, like when you were young, who is your celebrity crush? The first one, maybe your teenager, late, somebody who's like, oh, first time they came on your radar, you're just like all about them. Besides Shelby, of course.
Marilyn Monroe, I gotta say. I've always loved Marilyn Monroe. Oh my God.
Now, if you're going to be living, next question, on an island a year, you and Shelby hanging out, it's a beautiful island, but there's no streaming, there's no internet, and you can only bring one DVD of a movie and you can only bring one album with you, what would that DVD and what would that album be?
Okay, the album would be Kinda Blue by Tierney Sutton. That's my album. The movie would be Badlands by Terrence Malick. Terrence Malick and Martin Sheen. That's the movie.
Yeah, that's going back right there. Yeah. What a great actor, Martin Sheen. He's in. Now, if you were to define a perfect day, stem to stern, from time you get up to time you put your head on the pillow, what are the component parts of just a killer day for you?
Oh, killer day. I guess finishing something that I've always meant to do, but never got around to doing it. Rearranging my garage.
It's the small things like that. Yeah.
That would be a killer day. I started it and I'm partway there, but I got to finish it. I'm a professional procrastinator.
And it's time for the May meeting of the Professional Procrastinators Association. Yeah.
We're going to put it off till next month.
Now, if you weren't doing this for a living, if you weren't acting, doing comedy, being a cannabis advocate, what would your vocation be?
I would like to be a teacher. A teacher, say a philosophy. Yeah, a philosophy teacher.
Very good. I think you definitely have the street cred for it, without a doubt. I think you're still, in a way, I think you've already been doing that,
I have. I've been writing too. I write down a lot of philosophy. I was very lucky. I got turned on to the spiritual world by a jazz musician many years ago, and I have yet, I've got books that I always refer people to. I'm trying to see if, no, I guess it's in the other room, but yeah, I'm on that road.
Yeah, I was a big fan of you remember Alan Watts by any chance?
Yes, I love Alan Watts.
Yeah, it's yes. I still, when I used to work on, I worked on the radio briefly in LA, and I lived in San Diego and Encinitas, and I was driving. I would always drive. I go get my shake at the In-N-Out Burger, drive south, head back to San Diego, and listen to Alan Watts on, was it Radio Pacifica or something like that?
Yeah.
Now, last question. Now, if we could jump into a DeLorean and you could go back in time, you got a couple minutes with 16-year-old Tommy Chong. What piece of advice would you want to give yourself to get you on a better road, maybe bring more joy to your life in that moment? Just what piece of advice do you think would be essential to share with 16-year-old you?
Diet. The diet advice. That would be it. Although, let me think. I don't know. I'm so, I just really love my life the way it's been.
Talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he said something along those lines. He's like, if you change one, it's kind of like it's a farcical thing. If you like where you're at now, changing anything may put you on a different path that you may not arrive to where you are now, that kind of a thing. But no, man, I so appreciate you taking time with me again. And one last question. I'm just so curious because I had it written down here. I saw you actually, you've hung out, Willie Nelson, Snoop Dogg, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't know where I dug this up. And George Harrison. Who have you sat down with and smoked something with? Because I know there are people who are listening that are be really into this. Who was that person you would love to sit down with again and just smoke? They were like, okay, this is the person I want to converse with when I've got a good strain. And the second half of that is, what is your favorite strain? Because I know somebody's, because I mean, there are going to be people listening that are going to want to know the answer to that question. And I feel like if I don't ask it, then, you know. But who is that person and what's that strain?
Well, it was a guy that I almost smoked with, but he was having immigration problems at the time. I walked into a room one time to light up a joint, which I did. I lit up this beautiful Mexican sativa, I guess it was. And it was pretty stinky. And I'm smoking. I look down and there's John Lennon sitting on the floor. And I looked at the joint to see, am I hallucinating? Or is that John Lennon? And it was John Lennon. And so I walked over and I handed him the joint and he refused it. He goes, I'm sorry, mate. Can't do it. I've got immigration problems. I would love to go back in that time and tell John, forget the immigration. Smoke this shit.
Oh God, I can't even imagine what that would have been like. But yeah, you know, hey, feel free to promote, man. I mean, you know, what do you think is the strain that your favorite top strain? And you've got your own line out now, don't you?
We do. Cheech and Chong. We got Cheech and Chong pot. We got Tommy Chong pot. We got my favorite thing really is the these CBD night strains. This helps you sleep. But advice, they say put it under your tongue. I don't. It kind of messes with my teeth somehow. The only thing I would say is put it right down the throat. You know, don't mess with that under the tongue. It works.
What's the name of it again?
It's CBD, but it's called Nice Dreams. Nice Dreams. Tommy Chong's Nice Dreams.
I am going to try and find some of that down this way.
The Walmart was carrying it somewhere. You know, that's how popular they are. Yeah, it's a Tommy Chong CBD product. And you can go online, too. I think it's Hey Tommy Chong or something. But Tommy Chong CBD, you'll find it.
Very good. And what strain are you recommending right now?
We got a strain called Labrador. It was from one of our bits. What am I smoking? Oh, Labrador, man. Yeah, my dog.
I remember that.
Yeah. So we got a strain out called Labrador.
Oh, well, wasn't it because the dog pooped or something and the weed was in the poop?
No, the dog ate my stash. It took me I had to follow him around for a month before I got it back.
Oh man. Well, Tommy, man, thank you. This has been I know my 13-year-old self is going, dude, this is awesome. You know, it's just such a pleasure to sit down with you.
I'm glad, man.
Give Paris a hug for me. What a man she is. And I
will.
Well, my friend, you have yourself a great rest of your week and weekend, and hopefully we'll catch up down the line.
I really enjoyed talking to you, dude.
Well, there you go. Tommy Chong, a legend. And a really cool guy to sit down and talk story with. What a really cool career he's had, and some cool insights, some things I didn't even know about Cheech and Chong and kind of how that came together. And I tell you, this was fun for me and my inner 13-year-old self. Hopefully it was a lot of fun for you as well. Don't forget, storyandcraftpod.com. That is the website. Everything about the show is at storyandcraftpod.com. Thank you very much again. I want to extend my warmest, fuzziest, big, big hug, heartfelt thanks for checking out the show. Just make sure to subscribe. You get notified every time there's a new episode. And I don't want you to miss one because we've got some cool guests coming up. All right. Have a great rest of your week or the weekend. A great morning. Maybe you're doing something in the afternoon, or
just a great evening. Wherever you are listening and whenever you are listening, I hope you make it a really, really cool day. All right, I'll talk to you next time right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.